Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Nick Krokodilos, a top management authority, best-selling author, writer, speaker, and headhunter. Nick, with your considerable history of success, we are fortunate to have you here sharing your deep insights with us. We thank you for doing this interview.
Stephen, it's good to join you again.
Now, looking back, what were your biggest career challenges and why?
Well, I think my biggest career challenge probably mirrors what most people experience, and that was trying to figure out what kind of work to do after I got out of college and grad school. I was in a cognitive psychology program at Stanford University, living in the middle of Silicon Valley. I had no idea what kind of work I wanted to do, so I kind of fell into a strategy that I actually try to teach people now, and that's go out and talk to people who do the kind of work you think you want to do, and basically learn from their mistakes and their successes and try to get introduced to people who are interested in bringing someone like you on board. I just did a feature article for Phi Beta Kappa's Key Reporter magazine where I kind of addressed my young self. They asked me, what kind of advice would you give to liberal arts folks who are trying to get jobs in the business world? And what I basically did is I discussed how to use the fundamental skills that people develop in academia, you know, researching a topic, figuring out what your questions are, deciding how to approach developing some answers, taking all of that and applying it to your discussions with employers. So my biggest career challenge was figuring out how to get out of academia and into the business world.
So looking back again, what were your biggest career wins and why?
I think my biggest win was shedding the fear of getting into the business world and trying something completely different, taking a risk. I think a lot of people are saddled with their own experience, credentials, and history, and they're understandably afraid to go tackle something totally new. In my case, again, that meant leaving academia, going into the business world. Probably my next biggest success was turning my headhunting business into a publishing business, sort of growing another branch of it. When I first self-published a book back in 1995, that was a major win for me because it showed me that I could do something new. I could shift sort of over to the teaching side of headhunting, landing a major book deal with Penguin Publishing was a major success, and then parlaying that into a licensing business. Ask the Headhunter is now syndicated by Universal Press Syndicate around the world. That was a huge win because, as my lawyer puts it, you could take all the syndicated writers in the world and shove them into a Marriott Courtyard hotel room and still have room. So those are probably some of my biggest wins.
You know, you have this Microsoft webinar. Can you share some of the key messages?
Sure. What Microsoft does is, this is an interesting thing. Microsoft works with its external developers and obviously tries to help them use Microsoft technology more effectively. Once a year, Microsoft Canada puts on an event called Ignite Your Career. And what it's all about is basically helping developers figure out better ways to ignite and expand their careers. The theme this year, we did it last year. The theme this year is how to sell yourself, you know, in the job market. And I'm kind of going to take the contrarian point of view. What I'm going to suggest is, no, you shouldn't go out and sell yourself because you're not a commodity. What you should do is go out and sell what it is that you can do. Again, hearkening back to what I was saying about my own career, I think people often feel saddled and restricted by their experience and by their credentials. And what I want to try to get across to folks in the webcast on Thursday that we're doing is that you need to step back and ask yourself, what is it an employer or your target company, including your own company, if you're looking at your own employer right now, what is it that they need to accomplish? What problems and challenges are they facing? And then you need to step back and ask yourself how to rearrange and marshal your constellation of skills to go out and tackle that. So it's less a question of looking at yourself and selling who you are, and it's more identifying what the problem is and then reaching into your skill set and figuring out how to go sell that.
You know, how has your work evolved since we last chatted, and can you profile the services you currently offer?
Well, last year when we did this, I was headhunting and I was publishing. In this short year, I wrote my second book in 12 years after I published Ask the Headhunter, Reinventing the Interview to Win the Job back in 95 through Penguin. I actually avoided writing another book because publishing online, licensing my articles and features became a very successful business. But I also realized that with the economy and the condition it's been in, a lot of people are assailed and tracked by so-called headhunters. And I get a lot of questions about how do I deal with headhunters. And it finally dawned on me there are some answers I can provide here. So I wrote a new book called How to Work with Headhunters and How to Get Headhunters to Work for You. And what it basically does is address the challenges that people face when a headhunter contacts them. Number one, when someone calling themselves a headhunter contacts you, you don't really know if it's a credible headhunter. It could be anyone off the wall calling you trying to make a buck. Number two, if you're going to work with a headhunter, you need to understand how to leverage that service for yourself, even though the headhunter actually works for the employer. And finally, you have to know how to profit from the experience by knowing how to negotiate with a headhunter, which is very different from negotiating directly with an employer. A couple of additional services that I've added through my newsletter, the Ask the Headhunter newsletter is actually 7 years old this week. And with today's edition, I've announced some additional features, which include more dialogue with my readers. We have a how to say it topic in the newsletter where people basically say, look, Nick, I listen to your advice, but my problem is when I get into an interview, I don't know how to say these things to the employer. So people submit their how to say it challenges, and then I provide my input, and then we link over to the blog where other readers can provide their input on how to say it. And that's just become a wealth of fantastic information for folks because they're often smarter than I am. We have another feature which is just called the forum where people post challenges that they're facing that they want input from other folks on. I just announced a Talk to Nick feature for the past 15 years. I've had people ask me to please provide one-on-one coaching and counseling. But I really don't want to do that because I'm not a coach, I'm not a counselor, I'm a headhunter. So I announced a Talk to Nick on the Phone feature where for a nominal fee, you know, we can discuss a limited issue that you're facing without turning it into some sort of major engagement. We also started a feature where people can post requests for mentoring from others involved in the Ask the Headhunter environment, which we just started today, and I think that's going to be a very popular feature because, again, I'm not trying to compete with LinkedIn, but our Ask the Headhunter community is a very tight one. People who subscribe to the newsletter very rarely drop off the list. Consequently, they have a certain point of view, which has to do with delivering profit to employers, and I think that can be a very valuable source of input for the entire community to share.
So how do you view the current job landscape?
Well, the job landscape, Stephen, for people who are very good at what they do, never really changes, because even if you consider the companies are going through tough times, the best companies out there, which are obviously the only ones you want to pursue, even if they're laying people off out of one door for whatever reason, continue to hire top quality people in through the other door because they're not expecting to go out of business. They're preparing for an upturn. They want to have their people assets in line. They've got major projects that they're working on that will pull them out of the downturn once the upturn starts. So the job market for people like that is actually very good. Folks who aren't so good at what they do, I think the real problem is figuring out where they ought to be going and how they ought to consider changing their career direction so that they can approach companies that are the best in the industry and be able to present themselves as tops in their field. So I think the landscape is really prime right now. If you're very good at what you do and you can go find companies that need your skills, I think you can negotiate a good deal for yourself. It's also prime for employers because there's some very good people, so-called on the street, looking for jobs. They may even be unemployed through no fault of their own, who are willing to come on board for slightly lower salaries than they were earning. And what I tell employers is these are the folks you want to go after. But the secret is when you hire them, don't pay them a lot less than the market, dictates right now. Pay them what they're really worth. You will buy yourself loyalty as well as top skills, and when the market turns back up, you won't turn around and lose them.
So then can you provide your predictions of the job market for the rest of 2009 and then into 2010 and 11?
Well, if I could do that, you and I could both get rich. again, I think the job market never really changes, good people are always sought out by good companies. I think the transition that we're going through in the economy right now forces people to decide what kinds of target companies they want to go to work for. It forces them to decide what they're really good at. It basically makes people focus. So I think if you can, rather than be terrified or afraid of what's happening, if you ask yourself, what are you really best at? What motivates you the most? And pursue opportunities in that direction. I think it's almost irrelevant where the so-called job market is going.
Well, you know, this is sort of a related question, and maybe you've already answered it then. So what would be some of the longer-term work trends?
I think cottage employment, we used to call it cottage industries, cottage businesses. I think more people will be working from their homes. I think more people will be working as contractors. I think people will be working for multiple companies at a time, providing specific kinds of expertise. And again, this goes back to identifying and focusing on what your absolute best, most valuable skills are. If you can do that, I think companies will almost literally beat a path to your door, and you'll be able to pick and choose. And again, jobs are not going to be as traditional as they've been, I think. I think that people, even if they're working as employees in a company, will find themselves assigned to perhaps multiple departments or cross-disciplinary tasks. And if you're in an environment where your employer lets you work from home or where you have the advantage of running your own consulting business, I think the world is your oyster at this point. Because, again, I think companies that cannot afford the overhead of full-time employees are going to start picking and choosing from the best contractors and consultants out in the world.
So that kind of leads us back to your book then, and you've already referred to it already, but can you tell us more about your latest book and why it's a must-read today?
Well, How to Work with Headhunters really starts with a premise that I think some people misunderstand. What I try to point out is that headhunters only fill about 3 or 4% of all positions out there. So people have said to me, why would you write a book that's directed at only the 3 or 4% of people who might get a job to a headhunter? And the answer to that is far more people should be getting placed by headhunters, because headhunters take a rifle approach to matching people to jobs. A company can spend $500 to acquire 5,000 resumes from a major job board. If you stop and think about the overhead of them processing 5,000 resumes, it's a wild waste of time. A headhunter, on the flip side, will charge a company, say, $25,000 to $30,000 to fill a $100,000 position and deliver only 3 resumes or 3 candidates to the client. So that really begs the question, you know, what's going on here? Why does a company pay a headhunter so much money? That goes back to a very simple statistic that most people aren't aware of. Job boards fill only about 2 to 3% of positions. Headhunters fill only about 3 to 4% of positions. 40 to 60% of jobs are found through personal contacts. Now, to bring this around to closure, when a company retains a headhunter, what they're really paying for is not resumes and candidates. They're paying for that headhunter's personal contacts. So what I try to teach in the book is how to use and exploit in a positive way the personal contacts that you can develop out in the professional world. Headhunters tend to be hubs of great contacts. And what I try to teach people in the book is how to avoid the guys online who drop you an email and tell you, oh, I saw your resume on some job board somewhere. Have I got an opportunity for you? A good 95% of those are an absolute waste of time. People have a difficult time separating the wheat from the chaff, if you will, and figuring out which headhunters are legit, because I think most aren't legit. They're out dialing for dollars, trying to make a quick buck. What the book tries to teach people is how to separate the good ones from the poor ones. It also tries to teach, once you're working with a headhunter, how to leverage that headhunter so that you can get presented to his or her client company in a way that makes you the client's number one candidate. Finally, if you're at the point with the headhunter where you're going to negotiate a deal, there are ways to work with the headhunter to maximize the salary offer that you're going to get from his client, rather than letting the headhunter doing it all on his own. It's not mysterious stuff. It's really simple brass tacks. But if you've never been through the process before, you simply don't know how to do it. That's what the book tries to teach.
Yeah, so let's get into sort of more detail then. What role do the headhunters play in the current economy in filling jobs?
Again, it's almost always the same. They act as a top-level filter. They act as the personal contact who brings credible candidates into a company. And so you might think that the headhunting business is down because the economy and the so-called job market is down. But in fact, companies that are trying to fill very important positions. I don't even want to say very important positions. Headhunters don't just work on executive, you know, vice president, president level jobs. They tend to work on positions primarily that I would say are in the $60,000 to $150,000 range. And what a headhunter offers at that level to a company is credible referrals rather than, you know, the million fish in the sea that a company has to cull through on their own. So when companies are facing tough times, they need to fill critical positions. What they need is someone who can filter and who can bring credible candidates who aren't going to waste a lot of the company's overhead time in interviewing and sorting through the applicants on their own.
So how should the audience incorporate headhunters in their career development strategy?
Well, very carefully. Again, as I point out, if you start responding to headhunters' cattle calls online, you're going to wind up being another cow. You want to avoid scams. You want to avoid folks who are just fishing for resumes and trying to gather all the resumes they can, blast them out to their clients, and hoping they're going to get a hire. What you really want to do is check headhunters out for their reputation. What I tell people is if a headhunter contacts you, the first thing you want to do is ask for references. What companies have you done placements in? I'd like to talk to a couple of managers that you've worked with. What kinds of people have you placed? I'd like to talk to two or three people that you've placed over the past year. Most headhunters will share information like that as long as you agree to keep it confidential, because they realize they're not going to get great candidates who are careful about doing business unless they're willing to operate with you on that level. A headhunter can be a valuable tool, but again, headhunters, you don't call headhunters, they call you. So you need to be someone who's visible enough that headhunters will recognize you out in the market. And in order to do that, you need to hang around with people who are very good in your field. And a lot of people tell me, you know, I'm so busy at work, I really haven't got time to go out and circulate. Huge mistake. Everyone should be job hunting all the time. And what you really need to be doing is attending conferences, training programs, industry events, try to write an article for a well-known journal in your field, contact people who write those articles, get to know them, chat them up in a positive way. I'm not talking about the mercenary kind of networking that you read about in a lot of popular magazine articles. I'm talking about making good friends with credible, respectful people in your field who are actually the doorway to very good headhunters and to very good opportunities.
What are some gotchas, then, about working with headhunters that can cause problems?
Well, again, the main one I've already talked about a few times, and that's that there are... What we like to say in this business is that almost anyone with a cell phone and a pad and a pencil can get into the headhunting business. The cost of entry is so low that it tends to attract people who are not very savory. So again, one of the biggest gotchas is knowing whether you're working with a good headhunter or an unsavory individual who's out to make a quick buck. What I try to talk about in the book is there's a list of qualifiers that basically helps people figure out whether you're dealing with someone credible. And some of the tips are so fundamental that people just don't think about them. Someone calls you up, tells you they're a headhunter, they've got a great opportunity for you. First thing you want to do is ask them for the name and the phone number, the name of the firm. You want to ask them where they're located. You want a physical location and address. Even if they work out of their home, that's perfectly fine. You want to thank them for their time, tell them you'll call them back in an hour. What you then want to do is go online and do as in-depth a search as you can do to confirm the person is who they say they are. Are they really located where they say they are? Do they have a physical address where they claim it to be? If you call a number that you find through an online directory, will it lead you back to the person who actually called you? It's a very simple idea, but just as you wouldn't turn over your credit card number to someone who's selling vacation timeshares on the phone, someone you don't know, why would you want to turn your resume and your personal professional information over to someone on the phone that you haven't vetted?
Can you give us some good tips about how to make working with a headhunter more profitable for a job hunter?
Again, number one, you want to check the headhunter's references. And shocking as that might sound, it's exactly what an employer or a headhunter expects from you. So you want to make sure the person is credible, has a good reputation. Number two, you want to establish some ground rules. What you basically want to do is talk about the fact that, number one, the headhunter is talking to you about a very specific opportunity, and that opportunity is with a certain company, a certain manager, for a certain job. And you want to make clear that if you provide your personal information, like a resume, it's only to be given to that particular client for that particular opportunity. You want to get at least an email back from the headhunter assuring you that that's the only way your information will be used. Otherwise, if you have an unsavory headhunter on your hands, your resume gets posted online and it winds up circulating forever. A future boss finds it, thinks you're out job hunting. Other companies see it, you start to appear desperate because your resume is all over the place. You look like you're looking for a job everywhere. Some headhunters will do that. Knowing how to negotiate with a headhunter, let me try to give you one specific concrete idea. When a headhunter comes back to you and says, my client would like to make you an offer, it's very easy to get thrilled and say, great, you know, what kind of money can you get me? Start talking strictly about money. What's far smarter to do is tell the headhunter, look, I'm really interested in this job. I want to go on board. I want you to let your client know that I want the job, as long as we can work out the terms. This does an interesting thing. Once the headhunter knows that you really want the job, he can go to his client and say, my candidate's ready to come on board as long as we can work out the terms. That gives the employer a lot more incentive to try to work out a deal very quickly that will get you to make a decision quickly. A lot of the time, the headhunter and the client don't really know whether you want the job. So if you do want the job, it's a good idea to state that separately. That aids the headhunter in negotiating a good deal for you.
You know, there's this kind of odd situation in a way, right? Headhunters are paid by their employer clients. So how can I ensure that I'm protected and that, you know, that the headhunter is actually acting in my best interest?
Sure. Headhunters, the best headhunters out there really earn their living and develop their business, not so much by having great client companies, but by having good, credible access to the pool of professionals and the community that they recruit from. If a good headhunter takes you into a client, he or she is going to make very sure that you're happy when you go on board with the offer, with the company, with the job, simply because that candidate, that person that they've placed, represents an enormous amount of future fees for them in the form of future referrals. So if a headhunter is good at their work and has a good relationship with you, it's not just the fee that he or she is going to earn on this one placement. They're going to earn fees on potentially four or five more placements on people that you may refer to them down the road. So when you talk with a headhunter, you want to make it clear that you're well-connected in your industry, you know some great folks. The headhunter, therefore, has a lot of incentive to make sure that you're happy when you get placed, simply because he or she relies on future referrals from you.
Nick, you are really one of the top-ranking authorities out there in this area, in this space. You've got this great reputation and this incredible history of success, so you must have some great stories to tell. Can you share some of them with our audience?
Let me think. I mean, there are over the years, I've experienced some really unusual, surprising situations. I had one client at a major financial services company who had hired people from me, and I was talking with a vice president in another operation who also wanted me to do a search for him. And as we started looking into the definition of the position and what the second manager needed to have accomplished, it dawned on me that among the folks that I know out in the industry, the best candidate was the first manager, who was also my client in the same company. So what I wound up doing, it cost me a fee, but on the other hand, it also enhanced my credibility with both of the managers. I referred manager number one to manager number two, and I said to manager number two, this is the best guy for the job. You already have him in the company. This caused a bit of a problem because he now had to filch him from another department. But we were able to smooth that over, and manager number two wound up hiring manager number one. Again, I didn't earn a fee, but my reputation with the company went up immeasurably simply because I did the right thing. So not making a fee by placing someone within his own company was a pretty unusual experience. Another story from way back, when I was doing a lot of work in Silicon Valley at the time, I had a client who interviewed one of my candidates for an engineering position and basically came back to me and said, this guy looks very good, very talented. He said, we have a very serious communication problem because the engineer was into the United States from mainland China, had only been here a year or two. His accent was very heavy. He had a very difficult time communicating. And the manager said, I'd like to give him a try, but you know, I just can't take the chance. So I spoke to the candidate, and he came back to me and said, look, I really want to work for this company. It's one of the three best in the valley. Why don't you go back and tell your client, I'll come in and work for him for a week for nothing so he can try me out, so he can see that I have other ways of communicating. So I went to the client. Client came back and said, I'd like to try it, but my HR department has warned me I can't do it because of insurance reasons. And we can't insure the guy if he just shows up and he's not really on the books. So we knocked it back and forth. The manager finally said, you know what? I'm going to break with precedent. I'll take a risk. Send him in. The fellow's name was Sam. Sam goes to work, spends 3 days. Manager calls me up and says, this guy's fantastic. Not only am I going to hire him, but I'm going to pay him for the 3 days he's been here. So here we had a very unusual situation, which actually crops up on Ask the Headhunter periodically, where people ask, is it worth going in and doing some free work to demonstrate to an employer what I can do? And my answer to that is, yes, it is, as long as there's a lot of integrity on both sides. I've met managers and companies who will abuse candidates, implying they're going to give them a job, bringing them in to do some free work, getting part of a project finished, and then dumping them. So situations like that are a real learning experience. If there's a lot of integrity on both sides, it can be a wonderful way to introduce yourself to a company that ordinarily might not want to hire you.
You know, Nick, can you look into your crystal ball and give us some predictions of future trends?
Again, as I said before, Stephen, I think that the economy today, because of the condition we're in, I think there are huge opportunities for people who are very good at what they do. If people who are talented are sort of burying their heads down and trying to avoid being very noticeable because they're worried about losing their jobs, this is really the best time within your own company to take a look at what other opportunities there are for you to show what you can do. It's a good time to talk to other companies very quietly, because if you're very good at what you do, there are fantastic opportunities out there.
What are your top recommended resources and why?
Obviously, I think Ask the Headhunter is a pretty good resource. It's free. It's been online for 15 years now. My newsletter comes out every week, 7 years old. That's also free. Among other resources, I like services like LinkedIn, which are more communities than job boards are. But again, even there, you can't convince yourself that because you've posted information about who you are, that the world's going to come running to you wanting to hire you. You need to be very active in a good online community, provide value to the community before people start to regard you as an expert and someone who's willing to share. Other kinds of resources. If you're a job hunter in almost any area trying to figure out what to do next, Richard Bowles' What Color Is Your Parachute is always a good tool. But again, I encourage people not to look at any tool as the solution, because there's not just one solution out there. Mentoring, I think, is a very important tool that people don't pay a lot of attention to. Find yourself a mentor. Find someone in your field who can be candid with you about who you are, what you can do, and what kind of opportunities you might want to pursue. What I tell people, Stephen, is go hang out with people who do the kind of work you want to do. That's the best way to network and to get in the door and find the opportunities that you crave.
Well, we're near the end of our interview, so, you know, did we miss something in our discussion here? So if you were doing this interview, are there additional questions you would ask? And then, hey, what would be your answers?
That's a tough one. You've really covered some great questions here. I think the question I would probably ask myself is, what's the single best way to go find the job you really want to do? And what I tell people is, you can have a professional write a $1,000 resume for you. You can hire a coach for $10,000. You can post your resume on good job boards. You can pay a fee to certain fee-based resume and job exchange areas. You can do all that stuff. But in the end, think back on what we said at the beginning of this conversation. Various studies show that between 40 and 70% of jobs are found and filled through personal contacts. That hasn't changed in 250 years. People tend to get hobbled in the job searches because they think that databases and online tools are going to establish the contacts they need. They might. Being a node in a network or a record in a database may get you the brass ring at some point, but far more valuable is thinking about the fact that people still do business with people they know and trust. That means you need to meet the people in your line of work who are known and trusted in your field so that you can be pulled into that circle and made part of the inside group. There's a little article on AskTheHeadHunter.com called The Good Network is the Circle of Friends. And what it talks about is the ultimate networking, which is making friends, not just trying to, tie your star to someone else, ride someone else's back trying to get to an opportunity. You really have to become a friend and a contributing member of a professional community.
Well, I really appreciate that and all the insights you shared with us today. So, Nick, we will continue to follow your significant contributions in business and industry, government, education, media, and internationally, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and insights with our audience.
I always enjoy talking with you, Stephen. Hope your audience gets something out of this discussion, and I wish you the best. Maybe we could talk again next year.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Nick Korkadilos, top management authority, best-selling author, writer, speaker, and Headhunter.